It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, there are moves to bring bus rapid transit to Milwaukee. We'll talk about what that kind of transit is and how it could help the city.
But first, the scientific community is abuzz because researchers at the Laser Interferometer Gravity Wave Observatory, or LIGO, have announced that they have finally observed gravitational waves.
Gravitational waves were predicted by Albert Einstein as part of his general theory of relativity, hadn't been actually detected until now.
Joining us now to talk about that discovery is Sebastian Hines, professor of astronomy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Sebastian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, there's been a lot of excitement over this announcement, but before we really dig in, what are gravitational waves?
So Einstein predicted in his theory of gravity that space-time, the fabric of space and time woven together, actually can vibrate and it can ring and can transmit waves, just like sound waves travel through air, and that those waves could be one day maybe detected. And so finally we've seen his prediction confirmed.
So for those of us who aren't scientists, who haven't been tracking this thing, why is this such a big deal, this discovery?
So, you know, astronomers use light to observe the universe, and that's pretty much what we've been confined to for the last 400 years and longer. But this is basically a completely new window to observe the universe, and it tests fundamental theories of gravity and the formation of black holes and the universe, the formation of the universe at the very basic level. So this is basically one of those discoveries that have been, you know, in the making for 100 years and that can test gravity and Einstein's theory at a very, very precise level. And so we can now say that the predictions that were made 100 years ago are true and that Einstein was right.
Well, set it up for us. How were these gravitational waves confirmed? How do we pick it up?
So gravitational waves are, you know, these ripples in space and time. And what that really means is that space, right, the space between you and me, the space between us and the sun, can be deformed. It can actually be squeezed and stretched. And in this case, it was squeezed and stretched by two black holes, and we can talk about that, that were merging, they were colliding and coalescing a long, long time ago, far away in space, and the ripples, the stretching and squeezing of space, travels through space at the speed of light. And when it reaches Earth, it just ever so slightly deforms everything on Earth, because everything is in space, and so if space is deformed, everything is deformed with it. And so the way that this was detected was that very heavy weights were suspended very, very delicately in these two experiments. And when the waves, these space waves, came by, they moved the weights just ever so slightly back and forth. And with the laser interferometer that they built, they could actually detect slight changes in the position of these weights that were suspended as a response of the space waves going by, the gravity waves.
And what exactly is a laser interferometer?
So a laser interferometer basically means that you have a way to measure distances extremely accurately with lasers. And lasers are used because they are so stable in their properties, and they are very, very precise in their wavelength. And you can measure the distance or the change in distance between one place and another to extremely high accuracy. And they used a little trick by moving the lasers in two opposite directions and then measuring how the distance between one direction and the other changed relative to each other. And so without the gravitational waves going by, the lasers would not actually produce a light. And then when the gravitational waves squeezes the space in one direction and then stretches it in the other, then you see a slight flicker of light. And the flickering of light is what you want to look for. And the specific signal that we're looking for was, you know, a flickering at a periodic signal that goes on and off, and goes faster and faster as the two black holes they were colliding get closer and closer and finally merge. So they call it a chirp. So it's like if you make a noise and the frequency goes up. It's like a siren coming close to you, and you can hear the sound becoming higher in pitch.
We're talking right now about a huge new discovery in the world of physics, gravitational waves, something predicted by Einstein something like 100 years ago. And we're talking about it with Sebastian Hines, professor of astronomy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And you use the word chirp, and that's something kind of unusual about this. There is a sound associated with this finding, and we have a little bit of audio we're going to play. But first, tell us what we're going to hear.
So you will hear the ringing of space-time translated to sound. So the waves that travel through space made into sound waves, and the frequency, right, so what you hear, the pitch, is going to change as the black holes get closer and closer together. And as they get closer and closer together, they speed up orbiting each other. And as they speed up, the frequency also goes up. And then once they coalesce, the sound stops, because once they've made one big black hole, and there's no more wiggling of space-time because they, you know, the black hole has finally formed.
Okay, if you understood that, here's the clip. And one more time, because it's so short and sweet. One more time. So does it really happen that fast?
It happens much faster than that, actually.
Wow.
So this was sped up. And the reason that is because when black holes are extreme objects. You take, in this case, 30 times the mass of the sun, and you squeeze it into something that is the size of Madison, and then it becomes a black hole. And that's what we have here. We have two of these massive black holes orbiting each other. So, you know, like the sun and the Earth orbit each other, mostly the Earth orbits the sun. In this case, we have two roughly equal-sized black holes that orbit each other. And the orbital period, the time it takes, right, the year, basically, what takes a year for the Earth to go around, for those black holes, it takes a fraction of a second as they're so close to each other. And so the frequency that you hear, right, the pitch, is just the frequency with which the black holes go around each other. And as they get closer and closer, their orbit gets shorter and shorter. They become faster and faster until they start overlapping and merging.
Now, in a New York Times article that I was reading about this discovery, it said that black holes were sort of one of the more grim predictions of Einstein, and now we're seeing how they behave. What is it about black holes that we're learning thanks to this?
So this is, you know, the gravitational wave discovery provides a completely new way to test the properties of black holes that we haven't been able to test before very accurately. So, for example, this particular discovery shows that the black holes were rotating, so they had a spin. Everything rotates just a little bit, right? But if you look at black holes, even they can rotate, and so we are now able to measure the spin. We can measure how the coalescence of these two black holes actually happens. So, and how does space-time, the prediction of Einstein, how does it get warped when these extreme objects come close to each other? So these are all very new ways to test the predictions that are based on the theory, and computer models are now able to reproduce this, and that's how we can deduce the properties of the black holes by comparing them to very detailed computer models of this.
And Sebastian, just super briefly, if you can, how is this going to change things?
So first of all, it's going to allow us to detect many, many more of these things. So it's like a new, completely new window to the universe. I think the comparison would be if we had just discovered the telescope. So we weren't able to look at something in detail, and now all of a sudden we can see light from far away across the universe. Now we can see, for the first time ever, gravitational waves, messengers from extreme events in the universe, bringing news from these events that we can measure for the first time ever. So we can now look for the mergers of neutron stars, black holes. We can look for even more extreme cosmic events. We can look at the ripping of space-time itself that's predicted by some new theories of gravity.
Sebastian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Sebastian Hines, a professor of astronomy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us to talk about this huge new discovery in the world of physics, gravitational waves. Milwaukee County officials are taking significant steps in planning for a possible bus rapid transit, or BRT, route in Milwaukee. County officials are bringing in consultants to start planning a route and to look for federal and state funding.
Joining us now to discuss the project is Joe Pietrangelo, senior researcher for the Public Policy Forum in Milwaukee. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What do we mean when we say bus rapid transport?
So bus rapid transit is a type of bus service that tries to really mimic rail service by providing a faster, more convenient type of service, similar to a light rail system or even a subway system. So some of the key features of bus rapid transit are that buses operate in exclusive lanes, so there's no other traffic slowing them down. They stop less frequently. The stations tend to be allow for a level boarding, so the process of getting on and off buses is faster. You pay your fare before you get on, so there's not, again, the time waiting at each stop for people to pay. So a lot of features are combined to try to really make a fast service more like a rail service.
This is something we don't really see here yet in Wisconsin, but how common is it in other cities around the country?
Well, it actually got started back in the 70s in Brazil. The first system was started there, but now it's become more and more common in the U.S. and around the world. There's now probably around 10 cities that have really high quality or pretty high quality bus rapid transit services, and a lot more that are planning for it or that are kind of lifting their express bus routes towards a bus rapid transit type service.
You've been making the case for improved bus service for some time now, and with bus rapid transit being a top priority, maybe the best case. Why do you see BRT being a good fit for Milwaukee?
Well, there's been a long debate on transit in Milwaukee. There's been attempts in the past to try to develop a light rail system, and it's possible that that could happen in the future still. But bus rapid transit is a much more affordable way to provide a rapid transit service. So because Milwaukee has some financial challenges still with the transit system, we don't have any dedicated funding currently for transit. That's a long-term issue that needs to be addressed. But because of the situation we're in right now, having a bus rapid transit type of service can be an affordable way to provide a type of transit that just doesn't exist currently.
How much faster would this be than a standard bus ride around the route we're talking about, which we'll get into in just a minute?
Well, we looked at examples around the country, and tends to be around 25% time savings when a real high-quality service is put in place. That can vary a lot. It can be, probably anywhere from 10% time savings to a 50% time savings, depending on the corridor and the features of the system.
Well, take us down the route. Where are you looking at maybe having this first BRT line, bus rapid transit line, in the Milwaukee area?
Well, in our research, we looked at the east-west corridor, basically downtown Milwaukee out to Wauwatosa, where the regional medical center is, because for a number of reasons, there's the downtown and the regional medical center are the two biggest employment centers in the Milwaukee area, so this would connect those two centers. It currently is the busiest transit corridor, Wisconsin Avenue, going through downtown Milwaukee and west. There's about a three-mile stretch of Wisconsin that is the busiest corridor already. There's 17 different bus routes operating on that corridor. And then another reason why this area is a good place to look is because there's a planned reconstruction of I-94 coming in a few years, and so there's a possibility of having alternative options for people when all of that construction is taking place to be able to travel east and west through the corridor.
Talking to Joe Pietrangelo, he's with the Public Policy Forum in Milwaukee, looking at the idea, a proposal for bus rapid transit to serve the Milwaukee area. You mentioned this is a more affordable option compared to light rail, but it's not free. What kind of infrastructure changes would have to happen to make an effective bus rapid transit route?
Well, it depends on how the system is designed, but there would need to be changes to where stations are. There would need to be some significant improvements. The stations tend to be spaced farther apart, but they tend to include a lot more amenities for passengers, including the ability to pay at the station. So there would be machines set up where people would pay before they board. I have to say that the county is really working on this, so a lot of the planning and design of it depends on what they ultimately include in the system. But when we've looked at examples from around the country, the cost tends to start up a bus rapid transit line tends to be in the $5 to $10 million per mile range, which is compared to like a light rail system where the cost tends to be more in the $30 to $50 million per mile range.
And you mentioned the county taking lead on this. As I understand it, they kind of surprised you with the enthusiasm for bus rapid transit.
Right. So we put out this report in March of last year, and there has been other organizations that have looked at bus rapid transit for Milwaukee in the past, including our regional planning council. In June, the county executive made a proposal to actually plan for a bus rapid transit route, and currently they have an RFP out for a consultant that would actually work to plan the route with community involvement and working with the city of Milwaukee, the city of Wauwatosa, the county, the state, and other stakeholders to really plan how would the route look and who would be served, what would the ridership be. And then ultimately, they would be preparing a plan that they would submit to the federal government as they're seeking federal funding to really help start up the route.
Speaking of stakeholders, I understand there was some support from UW-Milwaukee regional planning students. Can you tell us how they got involved?
Yeah, the urban planning program, the two professors at UWM led a workshop that was exclusively focused on bus rapid transit for Milwaukee. What are the potential for it? How would it maybe look? And so, yeah, the students worked on designing an initial route. This initial route we've talked about from downtown to the regional medical center, and they also looked at kind of a bigger system and kind of envisioning, you know, if we started with this route, where could an eventual system connect the region more fully? So one of the big things that they added was the design element, because they showed what a station could look like. They showed how the dedicated lanes could look and how that would work with the flow of regular traffic and parking on the corridor. So that really helps people to imagine what it could look like.
Is there hope for state or federal financial support for this?
Yeah, so most bus rapid transit projects are supported in terms of the startup costs with a federal grant. Typically, the New Starts or Small Starts program. And what the county, Milwaukee County, is planning is to apply for a Small Starts grant that would help start up the project. So it would pay for 80% of the startup costs. As far as the state does not typically fund capital transit projects. However, there is an opportunity potentially because of this reconstruction of the east-west I-94 corridor that the state could potentially use some funding in that project for mitigation. So they would potentially put some money into a transit service as an alternative option for people during the construction.
And then I guess the big question, Joe, is if you build it, will they come? As I understand, there are some people who will always ride bus, either because of financial necessity or because of choice. Some people are going to drive a car, no matter what's out there for them, for that middle ground. Is this an option speedy enough that people are going to say, okay, I'm going to take the bus instead of the car?
Exactly. And that's where, you know, with bus rapid transit, you do have the potential to make buses much more competitive with the automobile in terms of speed. Also, because there is a chance that people will be, you know, introduced to transit who don't currently use it because of the whole I-94 reconstruction project, there is a chance to move people from cars to buses potentially. But really, this planning process that is about to get more underway with the county hiring a consultant to really work on the planning, they're going to be looking at, you know, what is the ridership potential? What do we actually expect this this type of service to produce in terms of ridership, and those figures have to really be competitive with projects around the country if we're going to receive the federal support that we're looking for.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Joe Pietrangelo, senior researcher for the Public Policy Forum in Milwaukee, talking to us about the proposed bus rapid transit project.
Coming up, our guest says the shifting demographics in America have given Democrats the majority they need to win elections and influence policy. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. There's more coming up on Central Time, and join us at 8 o'clock tonight for the PBS Democratic Presidential Debate. NewsHour co-anchors Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff moderate the debate live from the UW-Milwaukee campus. That's the PBS Democratic Presidential Debate tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our next guest has worked to get Democrats elected for decades, from Jesse Jackson to Barack Obama. Over the years, he's seen the demographics of this country shift, along with the passage of legislation like the Voting Rights Act and the Immigration and Nationality Act in the 1960s. The result, he says, is a new multiracial, progressive majority. That is, he says, if the Democrats don't miss the boat.
Steve Phillips joins us now. He's a co-founder of the social justice organization Power Pack, a regular commentator on NBC, CNN, and Fox News, and the author of the new book, Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Steve, you've said that this new multiracial progressive majority is there, and it's people of color who tend to vote Democratic combined with white progressives. But to take advantage of this block, you say that Democrats have got to let go of their focus on white swing voters. Can you make your case that the progressive majority to win elections is already here for Democrats?
Right. I mean, it's no accident that America elected its first black president when we elected our first black president. So since the changes of the Civil Rights Movement, particularly the Immigration and Nationality Act, as well as the Voting Rights Act, which allowed many more African Americans to vote, but from that time period, the number of people of color in the country has grown dramatically. People of color used to be 12% of the population, now grown to 38% of the population, and continuing to grow more rapidly, really frankly, every day. And so the cornerstones of this new majority are the larger, increasing numbers of people of color who are the progressive ones, who constitute 23% of all eligible voters. And there's always been an underappreciated but meaningful minority of whites who have voted progressive. That's 28% of the eligible voter population. And together, that's 51% of the American voting populace. That's the grouping that elected Obama, and even more importantly, reelected him when he lost 5 million white votes but still got reelected.
If the math is there, as you say it is, are Democrats doing enough, in your opinion, to capitalize on that, to get those votes counted on Election Day?
No, absolutely they're not. And that was my sense of alarm and why I really wanted to write this book, as a wake-up call to sound an alarm that the progressive movement, the Democratic Party, does not properly appreciate what has happened in terms of the demographic shift. And I've been very alarmed. People keep talking about Obama was a one-off and it was an aberration and once in a lifetime. We'll never repeat that. Whereas, in fact, he represented the cresting of a movement which is continuing on even without him, but it will only manifest itself if the party moves massive amounts of money into hiring staff and partnering with community organizations to mobilize voters instead of wasting money on 30-second TV ads chasing the conservative white swing voter.
Is it a foregone conclusion that the majority of people of color today and those who will come of age to vote are progressive?
Well, it's not a foregone conclusion, but in a country where the political debate at the moment is, are we going to round up 12 million people of color and ship them out of the country, and are we going to impose a ban on any Muslims or anyone who looks like a Muslim coming from the Middle East to come here, that tenor and tone of that politics tends to make people more progressive. And you pair that with the history of this country, which has was founded on the exploitation of the groupings of color, that they are in inherently progressive because of the conditions that they are in and how they have been treated in this country.
So given that you're talking about the current conditions of the country right now, is it possible that those conditions could change, that we could be looking at, if you're a Democrat and you want to get these votes, that we're looking at maybe a limited window of opportunity for a particular party, Democrats in this case?
Oh, absolutely. And so there's very much so a limited window, and that the last chapter of the book is called Conservatives Can Count. And so prior to the emergence of Donald Trump, many of them were very much on a more intentional and deliberative path to make inroads in the communities of color, right? The Koch brothers investing millions of dollars in Group Libre to try to organize and spread the conservative gospel among Latinos, Republicans elevating several different individuals of color into high political positions, three other presidential candidates, U.S. Senator Tim Scott, governors in New Mexico. So they were definitely on the path, and more rapidly than Democrats were. I think we were lulled into a sense of complacency by Obama's election. Trump has scrambled that equation now, so we'll fascinate to see how it all plays itself out. But the window is definitely closing.
We're talking right now with Steve Phillips, author of Brown is a New Black, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. And he says that Democrats have the multiracial majority that they need to win elections. And if they let go of their focus on white swing voters, they need to do that and focus more on people of color. And demographers have been talking for a while about the year 2044, which is when they think that the United States will become a majority-minority country. And you think that's the wrong way to think about it. How come?
Right. I do think it's the wrong way, I think, for two reasons. One is that it sets up a dichotomy, or a really oppositional framework, is that people of color will become the majority, and the implied in that, and then they will start oppressing all white people. So it's all white people versus all people of color, which is, you know, not that helpful. Also, 2044 is a long way away, right, in terms of, like, you know, waiting until that actually comes about. But I think one of the most important reasons why it's inaccurate is that there's a significant underappreciated, a very significant, meaningful minority of whites who are already supportive of issues of racial justice, social justice, economic justice. And so from the days of abolitionism to the civil rights movement to allies of the Black Lives Matter movement, you have a meaningful minority of whites who want to see a better society based on justice and equality. That population, partnered with a growing population of people of color, is a majority right now. We don't have to wait till 2044. We can and should be motivating that, mobilizing that right now.
There's a common narrative out there right now that Republicans swept into office to take majorities in Congress thanks to white swing voters, and that's why I think a lot of the emphasis you're talking about has been there. You don't agree with that take. So how do you frame what happened during that Republican sweep?
Right. It's not even a question of interpretation. It's just a question of looking at the math. And that was one of the most surprising aspects of my research, was to see that top Democratic Party officials and progressive had that conclusion. It's like, well, we were too radical, we were too strong on health care, therefore the voters swung against us, and then we lost the House and we lost the Senate. The reason Democrats lost the House is that the Republican drop-off in voters from 2008 to 2010 was 7 million votes, which is about normal for an off-year election. The Democratic drop-off from 8 to 10 was 26 million people didn't vote who had showed up in 2008, unmotivated, uninspired, unorganized, and ignored, and they decided to ignore the election. That's why we lost the House, not that the voters in the middle swung the other way. Our voters stayed home.
Well, obviously, Democrats and Republicans are going to want to court these voters that you're talking about. So how does it, so you're pulling for Democrats. What do you want to see Democrats do to take care of this group of voters that you say are so important to winning and shaping the future?
So I think there's three specific things that can be done. So one is putting forward an unapologetic social justice agenda that speaks to the realities of inequality and discrimination in our society, and that too often those realities are muted, and people don't want to, even someone as radical, you know, as Bernie Sanders running as a socialist, backed away from the issue of reparations, right? And so that those hesitancies are because of a fear of alienating white swing voters. So the policy agenda has to be that the resources have to go into the organizing people. Obama didn't just win because he was an aspiring candidate. He got 200,000 more black votes in Ohio in 2012 than he did in 2008, and he did that because they hired 650 full-time staff people to go into the communities who were from those communities, talk to churches, talk to community groups. And then the third step is that it's time to desegregate the office of the vice presidency. There's never been a vice president of color, never been a vice presidential candidate of color, and that's strictly because of a calculation on what you think the electorate will tolerate. Either of these Democrats are going to need to have a younger, inspiring candidate of color on the balance their ticket if they're going to galvanize this electorate.
To take that social justice agenda that you started with, I mean, that is something that either party could lay claim to, and it could be seen as a nonpartisan issue. Why do you think that Democrats would have the better swing at that?
Well, either party could, but the Republicans have been really had struck an alliance with the corporate elite, and they have put forward a worldview that people are poor because of personal traits and failings. And that business just gets it, government just gets in the way of business, and the great free market can reign. So their worldview does not accommodate specific steps and intentional actions to address inequality. Although much of the inequality in this country, most of it actually, was created through intentional government action. So the opportunity is greater on the Democratic side. But even there, there's still this hesitancy, right? That there's talk, you know, we talk about raising taxes. Is that too radical? You could end poverty in this country. I talk about this my book around a wealth tax, not an income tax, but a wealth tax just on the top 1%. Tax them at 2% of their wealth. They should be able to make 10% on that wealth, so it's only a question of them getting rich a little bit slower. That would generate $500 billion a year. Think tanks say you can end poverty for $250 billion a year. You could end poverty just by taxing people who have $13 million or more in assets.
We're talking right now with national political activist and commentator Steve Phillips. He's the author of the new book, Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. And we're looking at what this would look like, progressive white people joined with a multiracial group of voters, he say, constitutes that block to win elections for Democrats.
We want to hear from you. Do you think Democrats should be focusing more on people of color to build that majority voting block? Are both parties too focused on white voters? What would it take to see more diverse representation in elected officials, political operatives, vice presidential office? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with national political activist and commentator Steve Phillips. He's the author of Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. And he says that Democrats have the multiracial majority that they need to win elections, to influence policy, but they've got to let go of their focus on white swing voters and work instead on building relationships with people of color.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think Democrats should focus more on people of color? What would Republicans need to do to win them over? What are you hearing on issues of race from this year's presidential candidates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we go to our callers right now. We've got Rhonda on the line in Milwaukee. Rhonda, hi.
Hi. I'm one of those white progressive voters that have been waiting for a long time to have a candidate that I don't have to hold my nose to vote for. I really feel like our concerns aren't addressed by the majority in the Democratic Party who are in power. And I'm really frustrated. But I'm also really happy this election to get to vote for someone like Bernie Sanders, who I feel really does represent progressive concerns.
And do you feel like what our guest is saying, that being more inclusive to people of color is part of what you're looking for as politics moves forward?
Absolutely, yes. I think that, you know, the white progressives recognize the, you know, the white supremacy and the impact that it has on our friends who are people of color who, you know, are facing like significant sort of disparities in the criminal justice system and the economic system. And we want radical change. We really feel that, you know, that our country is being controlled by a small majority of wealthy people, and that it has a really pernicious effect on our democracy. We're also really concerned about the student debt that affects so many people of color and, you know, white progressive students who, you know, like me, I'm almost done with my PhD and I have over $100,000 in debt. How do you dig yourself out of that kind of a hole?
Rhonda, thanks a lot for that comment. And Steve, what do you say to that? And also, what would you like to see not just from the Democratic Party on this front, but also from white progressives?
Yeah, well, I think that clearly Sanders has energized and has attracted and mobilized particularly the white progressive sector of the electorate in a fashion. And he's making the argument, which I think is correct, that we have to expand the electorate and we have to excite people and we have to turn them out. So he's totally correct on all of those pieces. The next challenge is he going to be able to articulate a message that is galvanizing and mobilizing to voters of color? And I think there he's going to have to become more intentional and more explicit about racial inequality, racial discrimination within our society, as well as this issue around the vice presidential pick creates an opportunity. He could come out now and say he was going to pick somebody like, you know, State Senator Nina Turner from Ohio as his VP, and that would be a very galvanizing statement.
So we've got a Democratic debate in Milwaukee tonight. Is there a candidate that you think is doing better at this, building this coalition that you're talking about between people of color and white progressives? I mean, Hillary is the person that traditionally people think does better with people of color.
Yeah, so people have more familiarity with the Clintons than they do with Senator Sanders. So it's going to be fascinating. They're coming out of the first two states, which are, you know, fairly unrepresentative states, but they're, you know, fairly equal and neck and neck. And now they have to make their argument to a more diverse electorate. And so that's where we want to see more deeds behind the actions. They're going to commit resources to hiring from these communities and moving many millions of dollars in that direction. Are they going to put forward a policy agenda which deals with the police violence within the communities of color, and that it's more aggressive on immigration? If the Republicans can talk about rounding up everybody and shipping them out of the country, we can talk about providing legal status now and citizenship for people now, not 10 years down the road, and recognize that the whole issue of who is illegal is a complicated question in a country that was stolen from its original inhabitants.
All right. Thank you, Rhonda, for that call. And we're going to go next to Joe in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
We basically tried the electoral schema that your guest is advocating in the 2012 recall campaign in June. We had Tom Barrett at the top of the ticket, and we had that very dynamic, great firefighter trade unionist as lieutenant governor candidate. And we lost because the African Americans voted at a 23% rate. They stayed home, and Scott Walker got reelected. And until we get the African American community to vote in over 60 to 70% numbers, we are going to be losing these elections, especially here in Wisconsin.
Joe, thanks a lot for that call. And how do you get this voting bloc that you're talking about, Steve, to get out and vote?
So what all of the research shows that the most effective way to get people to vote is to have a friend or a neighbor or a trusted relationship ask them to vote. And so too many, I don't know the specifics around the recall campaign, how that money was spent. I do know that in general, Democratic politics in general, most of the money is spent on television ads. And that is ineffective in terms of getting people out to vote. So in North Carolina, for example, the Democrats spent $19 million in negative television ads trying to defeat Tom Tillis in that Senate race. That same money could have hired 400 full-time organizers to go door-to-door for an entire year. And so similarly, I think, in terms of the, I know lots of money, many millions of dollars were spent on those recall elections. I don't know how much of that money was spent hiring people from the communities to talk to their neighbors, to their fellow churchgoers, to their fellow community members.
And Wisconsin has a new photo ID law in place this year. It's also got a bill in the works that would eliminate elections deputies who can register people door to door. Other states may be looking at laws like these. They may have them already. Do you see that affecting this multiracial majority and weighting that you're talking about?
Yeah, well, it's no accident that they're doing these things. They're doing them when that they're doing them, right? And that, you know, I talk in Chapter 8 about there's two tools that the Republicans have. One is seduction, and the other is suppression. And so throwing up as many barriers as possible to make it harder for people to vote is the essence of what that is. At the same time, other places are doing online voter registration, making it easier to vote. I mean, we're a fairly high-tech society right now, and so we should be able to really streamline. Oregon and California are having automatic registration. You are automatically registered. You have to actively get out of being registered.
And Wisconsin is looking, just to jump in, is looking at online voter registration as part of that bill, but you do need an ID for that.
Right. Well, that would be a step forward. But this whole issue of the fundamental question is, do we want people to vote or not? And so if we do, there's proven steps that we can take to actually have significant increases in voter participation.
And, Steve, just briefly, as we wrap up, what's at stake to you, as you see it, for Democrats if they don't make the most of this opportunity that you're describing?
Oh, I think they're going to lose, that they will lose the White House, and they'll certainly fail to take back the Senate. And that's what we've seen. That's the incontrovertible evidence of the past 8 years, is when Democrats have invested heavily and turned out the multiracial new majority they've won, 2008, 2012, when they've run away from the president, when they've run away from this progressive agenda and have chased a shrinking sector of the conservative white swing voter, they have lost. And that's what's at stake in this election, is victory or defeat.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Steve Phillips, the author of Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. If you're like a lot of people with an interest in music, you might have that old guitar just sitting there picking up dust in your closet, maybe your attic.
If so, today's the day to pull it out, tune it up, and start playing. Guitar fans have declared today, February 11th, annual Get Out Your Guitar Day. So, what are you waiting for? Now, you've played.
I have played. I would not say that I play guitar. I've tried. I took electric guitar lessons when I was younger. I had my very own electric guitar, and I do have that acoustic guitar gathering dust in the closet.
Aha. So are you going to pull it out?
It's complicated. I want to. I very much want to. I've been told that I have the wrong strings on it, and classical strings, and so I could ruin the guitar. I want to, though.
So get it restrung sometime, but maybe today, maybe you got to plan ahead next
year. Yeah, what about you?
I never tried to learn guitar. I don't think I could do it, but I have a bass guitar. I started learning it, and then kids. And that really put a kibosh on the old bass guitar. But every now and then I think, all right, I got to pull that thing out and give it a try.
Yeah, kids really ruin our rock and roll aspirations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you still sing.
Yeah,
I still play saxophone.
Still
so, yeah, the stringed instruments, they take a back seat.
Well, it could have been someone, Rob.
It could have been a contender. No. If you don't know what to play, you could start with a classic, the bane of guitar store employees the world over who've heard the song a million times from wannabe guitar heroes. Yes, it's Smoke on the Water on Central Time.